Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 25th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Larry Rasmussen. Today's session number is 98-2, and it's titled, It Takes a Universe to Raise a Child. Let's listen in.
I have just 6:20, but I'd like to begin, so this is to let the tape ministry know that this is the second in a series entitled Christians Healing Earth, Earth Healing Christians. My name is Larry Rasmussen, and I want to pick up from last time at a particular point and argue that it takes a universe to raise a child. Aldo Leopold said one time, education, I fear, is learning to see one thing by going blind to another. What much of modern Western modernity has gone blind to in its very fruitful preoccupation with human subjectivity is that it takes a universe to raise a child. What was left behind with the rise of modern science and technology and with the Enlightenment was the medieval cosmology that the whole universe is alive, that we are a part of it, and that there's a reciprocity of relationships of human being with the rest of nature. And in what Carolyn Merchant calls the death of nature, namely that nature becomes other than us, outside of us, over against us, and essentially plastic in our hands for the construction of a world according to human design, what has been forgotten is that it takes a cosmos to raise a child, that who we are as human beings is only in our relationships with the more than human and the other than human, as well as with other human beings. So in order to get enough in to set the stage for a discussion, I want to move rather quickly through four elements, an introduction of kind of miscellaneous items that I hope turn out to be a mosaic of sorts, and then a short clip from a video entitled Keeping the Earth. We won't watch but a few minutes of it because I want to use it just to make a particular point. Then I want some time at that juncture for some discussion, your response to the video. What did you see? What did you hear? What did you feel? What did you think? And if there's time at that point, then I want to move through some major Protestant theologies of this century and kind of popular church catechetical points of views and materials in order to show the deficits in the way in which we have thought about our faith as Protestants in this century, in its failure to understand that it takes a universe to raise a child. We haven't had a cosmology, to use a different kind of word, worthy of the name in most Protestant theology and in most catechetical materials. And then at the end, then, this discussion of how do we together redress that. And the way in which I want to get into that is, I hope, a provocative statement that we, in fact, have two bodies, the one we know best, which is particular, I am here, you are there, and the cosmic body to which we belong. And that what has been forgotten is that we have forgotten our cosmic body. Okay, first the introduction of just some miscellaneous items. It takes a universe to raise a child is, of course, an adaptation of the African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child, and my argument is that it takes both, but that there's a connection, that the micro, the village, where a child is raised in circles of face-to-face relationships in communities of intimacy, is also where we learn, where the child learns his or her place in the cosmos, in the universe. And it matters immensely to our everyday lives what our sense of ourselves in the wider world is, where we are in the grand scheme of things, who and where we are in creation and its pilgrimage, what are we here for, where is it all headed? Those kinds of questions that come even with a young child are answered in the micro, but they're macro questions. I had argued in the last session that I fear that we, as modern citizens, experience a profound alienation from the rest of Earth, that we have a kind of species apartheid relationship, where as a species we see ourselves above and apart from and independent of the rest of life. That alienation is reflected in one of the studies, or it was actually a kind of poll of one of a major environmental organizations a few years back on a regional basis. It found that youth could identify up to 100 corporate logos, you know, the M's for McDonald's, Nike signs, etc., but could not identify 10 native plants. Now think a while what that means about the construction of reality. What's the real world if you can identify 100 corporate logos but not name 10 native plants? What is real in that world? Urban reality is another factor that plays into what I fear is a profound alienation. For the first time in human history, a majority of human beings live in urban centers. And that has happened very quickly. As recently as a century ago, the majority of people lived in villages and in the countryside. We've been around a while, not a long, long while, but it's a dramatic change in that in three quarters to a century, you have had the relocation of the majority of human beings to urban centers. For me, it means if we don't know how to green our cities, we're in serious trouble. There is then, I think, a kind of huge and urgent project, and it also pertains to Christianity. It's not just a pan-human issue, but it pertains to Christianity, how to overcome this alienation. And in the case of Christianity, I think Teilhard de Chardin's line is correct. People will not be converted to Christianity's promise of heaven until Christianity is converted to the promise of earth. This introduction was just a splashing of things. The last one is that I think it's both scientifically and religiously true that creation, the cosmos, the universe, is in fact one. You and I are quite literally stardust. We're the outcome of exploding supernovas as a part of a story that's now 15 billion years old. This is a great epic of evolution. I like Carl Sagan's line, it took 15 billion years to give us apple pie. That's right. Or the opposed thumb. the capacity to pray and to write songs. It's taken a long time, but it's all one story, and we are all one. There are some echoes of this in Scripture, even though one of the deficits of Christian scriptures is that it doesn't include the human tale itself, even for 99.5% of our history. 99.5% of human history has been a history lived out as hunter-gatherers, and nothing in our scriptures reflects that long experience of having to live on reciprocal terms with the rest of Earth. Would that we had that encoded into our scriptures, but we don't. We have 0.5% of human history encoded in our scriptures, and scriptures begin about the Iron Age when it's already a matter of human settlements and agriculture. But there are some echoes of this longer portion of our tale, which itself is only even a smaller fraction of the universe's pilgrimage. I'm reading from Psalm 139, 13 to 16. Some of this will be very familiar to you, but listen to parts that you may have not heard before, because as I tried to argue in the last session, we systematically filter out that which doesn't represent the human for us, and we filter out the more than human, the other than human. So you're probably familiar with this. "For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works that I know very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth." Now, did you hear that before? There are two wombs here. "When I was knit together in my mother's womb, and then when I was being intricately woven in the depths of earth. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of earth. Your eyes beheld my unformed substance. In your book were written all the days that were formed for me, when none of them as yet existed." So sometime long before you and I were conceived in this body, there was another body that we were a part of, the body of the cosmos, where we were being intricately formed. It's a interesting, I'm not making a claim that this is the kind of a cosmology that knew something about the long story of evolution, but it is an interesting fit that we're all stardust. It's just a huge recycling process. And you and I are one expression of that on the way from other things and to other things. There are echoes of that in the Yahwist account of creation, where Adam is created from Adama, Adam from topsoil. The Hebrew is, you can hear it when you hear Adam, Adama. Out of the ground God created Adam. But in Hebrew it shows it nicely, Adam, Adama. Then, so that's what it says in, for example, the Yahwist account here. "Then the Lord God formed man from," it says here, "the dust of the ground," probably topsoil would be better, "and breathed into," it says here, "his nostrils the breath of life, and the earth creature," became a living being. And then it goes on to say, "out of Adama the trees were created." Same thing. So you get something of this being woven from in and from the depths of the earth. In biblical Hebrew, you cannot make You do not have a word for human beings as a species. You can't think of human beings as a species apart. There isn't a word for that. There isn't a word that can distinguish nature and history either. And part of it is because it's one metaphysical reality. If you ask people after Adam, the farmer or earth creature, or was created from Adama, topsoil, who then was created when the Lord said, "It is not good that Adam should be alone," what is the answer you get? Who's created next?
Eve.
Wrong. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that Adam should be alone. I shall make Adam a helper as his partner." Next verse. So out of the ground, Adama, the Lord God formed every animal of the field and every bird of the air. Now, why should these folks be partners and companions? Because it's all Adama. When they are called living beings, it's the same word for them as it is for Adam. The King James couldn't, and the RSV for that matter, makes the distinction, always trying to find a way to identify human beings as a part, but the Hebrew doesn't show it. Now, granted, this did not quite take this business of the other creatures as the true companion. Then Eve is created. And there's something terribly important there. Nonetheless, it is the case that these are partners and companions because they are all stardust, if you put it in other terms. In the Yahwist account, the human vocation is to till and to keep. The word to till is the Hebrew word to serve. The human vocation is to serve the earth. It's a word which is also the basis of the word culture, and the word in English you still hear it a little bit, because culture, cultivate, and cultus, worship, all share a common root. So there is still an echo of this understanding that it takes a universe to be who we are, both literally, I mean in scientific perspective, and religiously. One conclusion I draw at the end of this kind of introductory comment is that if our God talk isn't about the God of all 15 billion years, if it's only even the God of the Earth's pilgrimage of 4.5-5 billion years today, much less only a God of the human tale, then we're worshiping a very tribal God of pathetic dimensions. And most of the Protestant theologies and most of the catechetical materials in this century have been about a tribal God of pathetic dimensions. Now, I want to show you a clip from the videotape, Keeping the Earth, which is produced by the National Religious Partnership for the Environment and the Union of Concerned Scientists. I will only show the very beginning. I did a retreat with the Marinol sisters a few weeks ago, and And we had a lot of fun with this because you will hear the voice of James Earl Jones speaking as God at the outset. And the Marinol sisters were having a chuckle of this. And they said, we fight, we struggle, we work all the time for feminine images of God. And God is as woman. And then we get James Earl Jones, and he's so persuasive, we're really up against it here. So, and then what you will see after this opening, in which, again, I ask you to just kind of take it in, and then later, let's talk a little bit about what you see, what you hear, what you feel, what you think. After that, then you will see just a short segment about the Feast of St. Francis at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York. Now, unless you get a ticket to what is in fact Eucharist in the largest Gothic cathedral in the world, you don't get in on the first Sunday of October. It only holds 6,000 people. And more than that, want to come to church on that Sunday. And you'll everybody comes. Everybody comes to church now. You say you all come. They all do. And you bring the New Yorkers. Bring their pets. These aggressive, hard-edged New Yorkers who insist upon going to church with the animals. And then the great doors open. The great brass doors open, and down the center aisle comes the elephant and the camel and the donkey, all coming to Eucharist. when Nyla and I went there at the first of the St. Francis festivals in October, we saw this amazing procession, because the procession then down the center aisle at that time was led by Bishop Paul Moore. Now, Paul Moore is about 6'7". And then when you put a bishop's mitre on top of that, you know, he's approaching 8 or something like that. Then there's a large staff coming down there. Well, Paul Moore is leading this procession, but there's a leash from Paul Moore's hand down to his dog, who is actually leading the procession. And the dog is a Yorkie. About this long. And looking very English, actually, nose in the air, you know, just leading this entire procession as if he were the bishop or she were the bishop. I don't know what this Yorkie's gender was. Okay, we'll turn the lights off.
There's one switch over on that side.
There's a switch back there. Can you get those?
Yeah.
Okay, someone was asking what old Who Moose was about.
Well, it's now.
No, it's has got to be its leader.
Are we still on the
earth? Yeah, beginning. Here we go.
In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness night. All the light that we have ever known is contained in a thin layer that wraps around the surface of the earth. Its mysteries challenge human comprehension. The search to understand them and their deepest meaning is at the heart of both science and religion. Some call this the creation. Some call this the biosphere. No matter what their perspective, all behold this vision and all. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth, across the dome of the sky.
We relate to God through God's handiwork. Nature is God's textbook. It's God's gift to existence. So to read God, we read nature.
So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves at every time. And every winged bird at every time. And God said that it was good. And God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good.
The creation was something to be deeply valued, precious for all of us. And I like to say that it doesn't matter how you view the origin of the creation, you come to the same conclusion. The diversity of life that surrounds us is a gift. It's something that was bequeathed to us, and it's something that we bequeath back down onto our descendants.
Thank you.
humankind. Male.
Okay, get the lights.
Was this a one-time thing, or did they do this?
It's each the first Sunday of October, each year. Yeah. Nancy, could you? There's a power button right on the top, at the back of the projector itself. If you could just get that right on the top.
Very top. Flush.
There it is. Right about there. You see it? It's
the back button.
Yeah. Thank you. If you're interested, I'm glad to pass along the information about where to get the video. It's an excellent video, and I'll just put that on the board afterwards. But tell me what you saw, what you thought, what you felt in seeing this and in listening to this. Just that short snippet at the cathedral.
That was so moving. I just can't imagine being there next to the aisle and watching those garland animals come out.
He seemed really joyful and he seemed really alive as opposed to dead worship.
The animals seem to belong. They seem to have peace in that place.
Why that is I don't know, but that's been the experience each year. There's never been a problem. I mean, you've got camels and elephants.
I felt like I understood why elephants sway like this for the first time. They're creeping time to the beach.
To the Kyrie eleison in this particular case.
It's an interesting contrast to have seen it and felt it, and then to read about it in the newspaper. I mean, I've read about this, and your tendency is to laugh. And I'm wondering what that's all about.
Why is that? My guess is that something is bridged. Something is bridged when you're there. Whereas when you're reading about it, you're still putting it outside of yourself. I mean, if the thesis is correct that we have kind of internalized alienation, and this is in fact what Paul Berman says, a moment of reconciliation, then being there, or at least being in the presence of that, even if it's secondhand, like this is a different experience than reading about it. It isn't me as subject relating to that as object. It's subject to subject.
I think part of that also relates to how so much of our worship is, and that so much of our worship is written and verbal and just like reading about it or hearing about you talking about it beforehand, and then we saw it, and our reaction to the visual is so different.
Yeah. I have a colleague, Tom Driver, who has a wonderful book called The Magic of Ritual, who says, paper does not for good ritual make. People looking at paper rather than seeing one another and being in one another's presence, unmediated. Yeah.
As I was watching it, I was wondering how full or empty is that cathedral usually for their worship?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, Julia.
It's not that full.
I just saw that many people, you know, and they really seem engaged. You know?
It's a very lively place, the cathedral anyway, and it has a wonderful set of ministries, but I don't know the answer to the question. I do know that now you have to get there very early and that the line goes way down the block and around the block, et cetera, to get in line because not everybody can get in.
For this event,
Carla.
I was there in 91, and it's an experience
I would, it's, you will never forget it.
But why is this an experience?
I think the two strands of the tradition that clearly come to life there. One is that when we praise God, that we join the chorus that has already begun. And I think you really feel that there, that you are joining the praise of God that other beings are already doing all the time. And you feel like you're joining a choir that's already happening. I think for me too that, and I love the way you did the Adama text, Larry, that there's a loneliness that is in me if I'm relating only to human beings. Put another way, there's an intimacy that I need to be whole, that I can have only with other beings, other earth beings anyway, that enhances and completes my relationship with God and with other human beings. And so in that experience, it's as if the whole family is there. And I think some people may laugh or read about it in the paper and think this would be cute for kids. And kids love it, but it's the adults that you see that are just stricken or smitten and deeply, deeply moved. Because kids, I think, automatically are kind of in that space. But adults, there's a joining or a meeting that can happen in that liturgy that they have forgotten or never had.
Paul Gorman says, there were tears.
Yeah.
He meant the adults.
Oh, yeah. There were lots of tears.
The children would not be crying.
No.
The adults would be crying. One reason for that is that a child has to unlearn a kind of natural reciprocity. A small child assumes that he or she can talk to the cat or the dog, has some sense that these are co-siblings of creation. Now it's a naive sense, it's an innocence, but we get that learned out of us. So when the reconciliation happens as an adult, a chasm has been bridged, and there are tears. For the child, it's this, it's the child on top of the shoulders of the parent responding. And it isn't a chasm that has been created.
And the din, just one last thing, the din is incredible because Paul Winter's concert usually plays live at that and has for some years. So you've got them doing their thing often with recorded wolf howls.
Yes.
And so the din in there is amazing because then people's dogs start getting into it. And so you've got all the amazing animals from the elephant down to the paramecium.
Yeah.
But then you've got other people's domestic animals just going in it. But I've heard that never has there been a problem.
Not yet.
There's certainly when I was there. But the din is kind of amazing.
Yeah. Just recall the purpose of a cathedral because it's wonderfully illustrated here. A cathedral is to be a microcosm of the cosmos. When one looks to the heavens in the cathedral, namely the ceiling, you are to understanding that you're looking to the heavens. That this is the whole universe in a confined space made sacred, or rather the whole is sacred, but this epitomizes it. And so this sense of everything being present in this space is communicated and communicated vividly there. Yeah, and it probably is the case, though there are now almost 6 billion of us, if it's us alone or quite lonely. What else did you see or hear?
What struck me, although this is probably, from what you just said, this is probably the selection of things that they showed in the video, but it was like all of creation is singing the Kyrie in unison, because they showed, the person's hand on the bird was just happily going back and forth with it, the child, the chimpanzee, everyone was doing, and the dancers were all doing it in unison. It was, it was a unity that we don't normally experience.
I was wondering if, since you mentioned these very urban people, if there is more of a yearning for a connection with the animals because they live in this very urban area.
Yeah. I think we probably are deep in our genes, well aware that we belong to a larger community of life than our species alone. And whether we live in urban centers or not, there is that in us which can't simply blot out the long history of being human beings in some kind of relationship with the other and more than human, and that's even true for New Yorkers. And of course, New Yorkers are notorious for having lots and lots of pets. Yeah, one room apartment in New York has probably got a big dog, and for using the parks, etc. So there are connections there as well. Yeah,
I can see how this reconciles people with the animals. I'm not sure how it helps us understand and how people understand what the animals need. It may actually give a false impression of anthropomorphizing these animals into that setting, giving without really understanding that this is not what these animals need to live.
Or cultivating what we talked about briefly last time as a kind of nature romanticism on the part of the participants there too, that we're all swaying together, you know, and that this is a harmonious universe when that isn't the case, much less seeing it from the point of view of some other interests than our own. We will have to read it from a human point of view. We can't be anything but anthropocentric in our perspective, but we don't have to be anthropocentric in our interests. And that would take something beyond. But it probably can't happen well without some moment of reconciliation like this, some felt unity or sense of belonging to a larger community of life. Yes, Ginny.
This really touched me because I immediately went back to when maybe I was 7 or 8 years old, and though I grew up on a farm and we had lots of animals around, I can recall asking my mother once if animals went to heaven. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, only people can go to heaven. Yeah. And I can remember walking with my dog down this lane through the farmyard and decide if my dog couldn't go to heaven, I didn't want to go there.
That's right. I mean, if you can't be with your best friends, hey.
I think that was the end of many of our church school careers. Seminary.
No, I mean, most of us probably have childhood memories of a favorite pet dying and asking that question, and also feeling the need to have some rather elaborate funeral service. I remember when our dog Petey died, that was a crisis, and we had to go through the proper rites there. Is it true that your dog didn't go to heaven?
I think
there's
a place for all creatures.
No,
yes.
I've had a question that's been buzzing around, a theological question. That is, this goes back to what you began with some of the what we teach in catechism, that sort of thing. It's not so much Adam, but it's the second Adam. In other words, when does the incarnation begin?
No.
I mean, this seems to be part of the problem in terms of how we think about creation and the scope of time and in other words, it's a Christological question.
Yeah.
When does the incarnation begin?
Yeah. Yeah. And what our understanding of the incarnation is, because there are traditions, and one of the deep traditions in Christianity that does insist upon a very fulsome understanding of creation is a tradition of kind of sacramental communion, where the presence and the real presence of God is found throughout the whole created order from the moment of creation on. And then when one talks about the incarnation of Jesus, of God in Jesus Christ, you're talking about a moment in an ongoing history of God's, of the nature of God as being genuinely incarnate. I didn't mention when I referred to the Yahwist account in the creation story that the Hebrew word for air and breath and spirit, namely ruach, is the same, and you can't tell except in context whether it's a rod or to the breeze that comes down the valley or the air that you take in. And part of that is, again, an echo of an understanding of a world in which the presence and the power of God is, to use Luther's language, in, with, and under all things. So that's a profound notion of incarnation. And when incarnation begins is with creation. And then the argument, of course, is that even Christologically, the argument in that tradition is that is a cosmic understanding of Christ, and that in, to use Paul's language, in Jesus Christ all things cohere. Or to use the beginning of the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And that Word is then identified with Christ. I mean, Jesus Christ makes the incarnation in a particular Jew in the reign of Caesar Augustus an instance of the presence of a Christic or Christological understanding of the whole created order. Christ isn't Jesus' last name. Yeah.
Is there a different or better way to understand the Genesis story then, when at the end of listing animals, it seems to be understood that humans are in charge of this, or something that are superior to all of this?
Yeah.
Which I don't think is really be.
Well, I recall the confirmation class, and I don't remember many of those sessions, but I do remember the one when Adrian Poynter, we all laughed a little bit at Adrian Poynter because we didn't think Adrian Poynter was too sharp. But Adrian Poynter asked the Pastor Olson why it was that in one of these chapters human beings were created first, and in the other one human beings were created last. And Pastor Olson said, well, they both mean the same thing, namely, that we're the most important. That wasn't altogether convincing to Adrian Poynter, but the rest of us didn't challenge it at the moment to make the argument either way. No, I think that in order to have a reading of those texts, one has to sort them out according to their own traditions and how they're functioning. In the Yahwist creation account, you have the point of view of a kind of peasant farmer. And there, the identification of human beings is actually first and foremost with the land. Adam out of Adama. This is where your life is. And the human vocation is to serve the earth. More specifically, to serve the topsoil, or to serve the life. We would say now the biosphere, the envelope of life. In the priestly account, that's the account where you get identification of human beings with God and being created in the image of God. You don't get it in the other one. So you have to start sorting them and putting them in conversation with one another. Jewish exegetes have been better at putting them in conversation with one another and not trying to read them as a single account about human origins and our place in the scheme of things, but understanding them as two different accounts, stories, if you will, and then playing with them as you do. But you get very different readings in the two different accounts. Both of them are, in some sense, kind of hierarchical, and I think that in part reflects the age. All of us understand our scriptures and the rest of our stories in keeping with the compelling issues of our age and the context in which we live. And this, as I said, comes into being at the time of the Iron Age, when it is a matter of human settlements, and when having dominion is important because the forces of nature are the threats to your existence as well as the gifts. You know, so, yeah.
I had two thoughts. The first one, if someone said that there was no problem with these animals, does that mean they were all continent?
They were what?
All continent.
No.
That is, they didn't urinate at
different places. The pooper scoopers were on hand for the event.
Okay. The second question, I wondered what the response would be to the parishioners of the community if instead of animals they had an annual procession of the least of these, the beggars, the street people, the prostitutes, the lame, and all.
That's why in response over here I said I think the propensity to interpret this as moderns alienated very often from the rest of nature in terms of nature romanticism works better than if you were to confront class differences, racial, ethnic differences, etc. This is kind of overcome in some grand harmony where those differences sort of fade. And they wouldn't fade if you made that a matter of procession. And one must say that the Cathedral of St. John the Divine is highly aware of those issues as well in the ministries, but it doesn't show up in this particular thing. One thing I wanted to share with you, I think we're not even going to try to march through the Protestant theologies, but I did want to share with you a segment from the Brothers Karamazov, because a number of you had mentioned that in watching this, you noted the Kyrie eleison and the motion and so on. There's a very moving section in the chapter in the Brothers Karamazov called Cana of Galilee, where the closing scene centers on Alyosha, whom Dostoevsky just calls the little man of God, as the figure. Alyosha goes late at night to the monastery cell where his spiritual mentor, the saintly old Zosima, who is one of the major figures in the Brother Karamazov, lies in his coffin. Now this isn't between the animals, this is between young Alyosha and his spiritual mentor. And of course the scene always comes only after all those tumultuous tears and tortured relationships. You got to get through a lot of love, betrayal, etc. for pages and pages and pages in any thick Russian novel. But once you get through that, Alyosha in the candlelight hears the account of Jesus' first miracle of water to wine at the wedding in Cana being read by the monks around the coffin of old Zosima. Exhausted, Alyosha falls to his knees and drifts from the words into prayer and his own kind of running commentary on the familiar verses. And in this dreamlike state, Alyosha suddenly hears the voice of Zosima, who, from the coffin, reaches over the side and extends his hand to Alyosha and raises Alyosha from his knees and says, "Let us," then Dostoevsky writes, "Let us make merry," the dried up old man says. "Let's drink new wine, the wine of new gladness, of great gladness." and a little later, begin your work, my dear one, my gentle one. Well, it's in this moment of tender invitation and new vocation that Alyosha, who in fact had fallen asleep on his knees, suddenly awakes. He goes to the coffin briefly, turns abruptly, and exits the cell. And then Dostoevsky writes this: Alyosha did not step on the steps, but went down rapidly. His soul, overflowing with rapture, was craving for freedom and unlimited space. The vault of heaven, studded with softly shining stars, stretched wide and vast over him. From the zenith to the horizon, the Milky Way stretched its two arms dimly across the sky. The fresh, motionless, still night enfolded the earth. The white towers and golden domes of the cathedral gleamed against the sapphire sky. The silence of the earth seemed to merge into the mystery of the stars. Excuse me. The silence of the earth seemed to merge into the silence of the heavens. The mystery of the earth came in contact with the mystery of the stars. Alyosha stood, gazed, and suddenly he threw himself flat upon the earth. He did not know why he was embracing it. He could not have explained to himself why he longed so irresistibly to kiss it all, but he kissed it, weeping, sobbing, and drenching the earth with his tears, and he vowed frenziedly to love it forever and ever. Water the earth with the tears of your gladness and love those tears. It rang in his soul. What was he weeping over? Oh, he was weeping in his rapture, even over those stars which were shining for him from the abyss of space. And he was not ashamed of that ecstasy. It was as though the threads from all those innumerable worlds of God met all at once in his soul, and it was trembling all over as it came in contact with other worlds. It takes a universe to raise a child. He wanted to forgive everyone and for everything, and to beg forgiveness. Oh, not for himself, but for all and for everything, and others are begging for me, it echoed in his soul again. But with every moment he felt clearly and almost palpably that something firm and immovable, like the firmament itself, was entering his soul. A sort of idea was gaining an ascendancy in his, over his mind, and that for the rest of his life, forever and ever. He had fallen upon the earth a weak youth, but he rose from it a resolute fighter for the rest of his life. And he realized and felt it suddenly at the very moment of his rapture. And never, never for the rest of his life could Alyosha forget that moment. Someone visited my soul in that hour, he used to say afterwards with firm faith in his words. 3 days later, he left the monastery in accordance with the word of his late elder Zosima, who had bidden him, now newborn to earth, to sojourn in the world. And that's where the chapter ends. But I thought of that with the Kyrie Eleison, because he begged for forgiveness for everything, not for himself, but for everything that was part of it. Okay, our time is virtually up, but I just want to leave us with the question of how we would now kind of constructively go about the business of raising the kids, raising the adults, in such a way that our bodies, the ones we know best, are understood to be one of the two bodies that we inhabit. that the other body is the cosmic body. A friend of mine, John Rain, says, we all have two bodies. The first is our inside the skin body. It's the only body most of us think we have. It's the one that particularizes us. Me here, you there, end of the 20th century rather than the 10th century or the 22nd century. And most of us think it's the only body we have, but it's not so. Just as intimate to us, just as immediate, just as indispensable for our personal lives, including our thinking and our feeling, is our outside the skin body, the great body that we're a part of. And how interdependent are we? Try to go a week without water sometime. Try to go an hour without breathing sometime. You will find connections between your inside the skin body and your outside the skin body very, very quickly. Likewise, the biosphere, which you saw at the beginning of this video, is itself created by all of us together. So that the air, the atmosphere itself, is a result of all sorts of actions of the creatures themselves. You can't live without the green plants. The green plants rely upon you. You belong to the same body that they belong to. And when youth can identify 100 corporate logos and not name 10 native plants, I fear that they don't understand what we too often don't understand, that we've got two bodies. And even before we were knit together in our mother's womb, we were knit together in the depths of the earth. And so it will be after our particular bodies also depart and make their contribution to the ongoing community of life. Well, I wish we had more time for discussion, but we're going to go over and go curious later.